Our book, The First Principles of Philosophy, was written somewhat over 20 years ago. And it is inevitable that in the years of research that followed after the publication of the work, some points of interest should arise. And a discussion of this kind, of a kind of commentary or addenda to the original work, is probably useful and reasonably meaningful. Our first branch of philosophy is called metaphysics. And I think we have to realize that in ancient times, the term philosophy itself extended over a very large part of ancient learning, including many subjects that have since been divided into specialized fields. Essentially, the foundation of philosophy is the metaphysical part. Thus, in nearly all ancient systems, it is placed first as the primary or groundwork for the entire study of philosophy. The term metaphysics comes from the Greek and means, rather simply, beyond physics. Beyond, in this case, means further from the appearances or the material aspects of things. It means beyond the ordinary researches into the mysteries of nature and the formal studies and of the phenomenal universe which we inhabit. It may be said briefly that metaphysics deals with the hidden parts of physical procedure. It was known and recognized by the ancients that all visible things flowed from invisible sources. All nature was supported upon invisible foundations. Life itself, though infinitely manifest in its diversity, is concealed and unknowable in its origin. Metaphysics, therefore, covers the invisible origins of things which gradually move into a visible state. And it may also be said to be concerned with other things, not only invisible in origin, but remaining invisible, having no exact manifestation on the material plane of life. The first philosopher of distinction to devote a complete work to the study of metaphysics was Aristotle. And as we study his remarkable volume, which is named The Metaphysics, we realize, perhaps more fully than in any other of his writings, the extraordinary genius of the man. We come to know clearly that Aristotle did not deny the existence of a transphysical universe. He did not for a moment question the secret fountains from which all manifestations flow. He did, however, take the basic attitude that there is no interruption of what might be termed the grand pattern of physics. Metaphysics was therefore the better part of physics itself. It was not a separate study or a separate consideration, but merely the extension of physical knowledge toward the world of causes, where things are less obvious or evident, more difficult to measure and to estimate. Perhaps Lord Bacon summarized Aristotle's position rather well when he said that when physics properly understood, there will be no further need for metaphysics. In other words, these two terms cover the hemispheres of a single sphere. Metaphysics is nothing more nor less than the orderly extension of the universe back toward its own cause. Man attempting to understand, attempting to rationalize, those parts of the creative processes which do not directly come within the area of the sense perceptions. Aristotle would have taken the position that if man was able suddenly to open new eyes within himself and was able, therefore, to observe the universe with more skillful or adequate faculties, he would find that there was no break between the visible and the invisible. What we call the break is the boundary of our own sensory perception. It has nothing to do with the orderly structure of the universe itself. Also, there was nothing in the classical concept of metaphysics that can be compared with the popular usage of the term as we so often find it today. Today, metaphysics has become a synonym for a kind of liberal religious mysticism. This is not actually contrary to the meaning of the word, but it certainly does not fully explain it, nor are the various religious sects which regard themselves as metaphysical, are devoted to the primary objects of this branch of philosophy. Metaphysics is not a faith any more than physics is a faith. Metaphysics is an area for research. But we are not able to use in this area the same instruments with which we carry on our exploration of the hemisphere of physics. We cannot use the equipment that is set up to measure things that are tangible, that have immediately recognized dimension, that can be captured in various experiments or made known to us by the cunningly contrived instruments and devices which we have gradually perfected. Therefore, we have only one essential way of exploring the area of metaphysics, and that is by the reasoning power of the mind. Now, the reasoning faculty is again something which we do not too greatly understand. Reason is not acceptance, nor is it belief, nor is it faith, nor can it be regarded as a form of superstition. As Plato points out to us, reason is an instrument. Reason is just as certainly a scientific instrument as the telescope or the microscope. But both of these instruments have to be skillfully prepared. And if the telescope is not made by one thoroughly versed in the production of such instruments, it will be faulty and probably of very little value. In the same way, reason, unless it is cultivated, unless its processes are sharpened by clarity of thinking, can do very little to help us to discover the reasonable. The end of reason is to discover that which is reasonable. We say reasonable because we cannot, within the proprieties of philosophy or science, say the discovery of that which is true. We have every reason to believe that if we can be completely reasonable, we will arrive at truth. But we are not sure that man is capable of perfect reason, any more than we are sure that he is capable of creating a perfect device or even an infallible instrument. Every instrument, device that we have ever created, we have improved down through time. Even after we believed that we had reached a degree of perfection in which no further improvement was probable. It is the same with the reason. No matter how skillfully we train it, no matter how judiciously we use it, we realize that we are working with a living faculty or power. That this is an instrument subject to growth, subject to improvement in and of itself, and also that it belongs to a being continually evolving, continually increasing in insight and knowledge, and enlarging the areas of its skill. Thus, we can say, with more or less conviction, that that which is reasonable nearly always proves to be true, but this is not infallible. But then, there is nothing in knowledge that is infallible. Reason permits us to explore areas where the faculties which we commonly employ cannot penetrate. But reason does not permit us to come into conflict with common sense, nor does it enable us to assume that any extension from the known and from the visible shall be in conflict with the known and the visible. We do not find such conflict in nature. We find that all things are suspended from their proper causes, that these causes are consistent with the effects which they produce, and the effects in turn bear witness to their causes. We learn, however, by the use of reason, that it is possible to estimate the nature of many causes by a consideration of the effects suspended from them. Thus we come to the point of the Aristotelian philosophy, the a posteriori concept, that from the study of effects we may come finally to participation in the nature of causes. This use of the reason to explore the area of metaphysics usually requires that we have a profound judgment, a skillful and adequate training, that we are fully equipped with what is known on the subjects which we investigate, and that therefore we do not regard metaphysical insight as in any sense of the word something that takes the place of knowledge, something that is better than the reasonable faculties. Rather, that it is the best way that we have of using the total power to know which we possess. Reason, therefore, becomes our all-sufficient guide. And by means of it, we come to certain conclusions. These conclusions have stood the test of ages. And while in various periods of history, that which is reasonable has been assailed and declared to be beyond demonstration, the world, in the end, always returns to the reasonable, referring it even to the factual. The reason for this is that the factual, as we understand it today, has a quality of sterility about it. Facts are, for the most part, static. They are not dynamic. One of the reasons for this is that the facts that we are able to comprehend are terminal facts. There is much that precedes them, but very little that follows after them. Therefore, to possess facts does not mean that we have keys which open new doors. We have only the power or the privilege or the ability to contemplate these things which we have observed. And from this contemplation come finally to the same conclusions that we originally held. Thus, facts are not exceptionally stimulating. And very few facts have great solutional value. These facts become the obvious thing. And around the structure of the obvious, we build an almost total indifference. Facts, therefore, have a tendency to blunt our interests. They cause us to substitute the obvious for the reasonable. They disincline us to effort, investigation, and the arduous pursuit of knowledge. Possessing what we call facts, we feel that we have the better part of knowing, and therefore falsely assume that our knowledge is complete. The difference between facts, therefore, and things reasonable must always be that we are seeking not merely for that which is evident, but for those causes which explain the evidence. Reason, therefore, is forever seeking the reason for things, the reason for conditions, the reason for circumstances. And the training the reason becomes dynamic because it causes us to be attentive to the conditions or circumstances which are prior to the obvious. We may therefore say that history will tell us that in 1492, Columbus, shall we say, contacted the Western Hemisphere. This fact, however, is of small, vital knowledge. It can be memorized and forgotten. But behind this fact itself is the tremendously dramatic story of the circumstances which led to the voyages of Columbus. These voyages were an effect, the cause of which lay deeply hidden in the complications of European statescraft, in the opinions and attitudes of men, in the prejudices and intolerances of the time, in ancient traditions, and in old records that we scarcely ever bother to examine. Thus, facts are like icebergs, the greater part of the important value being submerged, and metaphysics must deal with the study of these submerged or invisible factors, without which visible things have little or no essential meaning. It is obvious, therefore, that to work into the research of a metaphysical nature, we have to become explorers of a difficult and sometimes dangerous country. We have to leave behind many familiar things, but always trusting upon principles, we must advance our studies systematically, thoughtfully, reasonably, cautiously, and yet at the same time with no arbitrary restrictions imposed by prejudice or intemperance or intolerance of attitude. Thus, metaphysics is really that part of learning which man some way most favors, because it is his only way of trying to explain himself, trying to find out where he came from, the reason for his own existence, the true nature of the universe in which he lives, the laws which govern creation itself, the energies which abide in space. All of these imponderable values cannot be reached by the common processes of knowledge. They belong, therefore, to the sphere of metaphysics. And with this realization, we see how rich this sphere is, how meaningful it can be, but how carefully we must consider it, always observing that it is a lawful area, not a region of mysteries or enchantments, not a fantastic dwelling place of monsters, nor a world of fairy tales and nightmares. This invisible world is actually the greater part of existence. For if man could estimate the terms of what he knows in terms of that which is to be known, he would realize how very little he has accomplished. Man is still living in a very small area of light, in an infinite region of uncertainties. Metaphysics begins, usually, with what is commonly known as ontology. An ontology is that general branch of learning which deals with the effort to discover the nature of being. It seeks the answer to the question, who am I? It also seeks to go beyond this point and to discover, if possible, that being, substance, essence, or nature, which is at the root of existence, and which must be assumed to exist. Now, this comes to one of the first points of possible conflict between science and philosophy. Philosophy, particularly metaphysics, insists that it is the only reasonable solution to the mystery of existence is that this mystery is suspended from being, from a fact of some kind. This fact is unknown and invisible. And whether we regard it as a substance or an essence, a creature, or a force of some kind, there has to be, according to the reasonable concept of man, a reasonable power at the source of existence. If there is no such reasonable power, if reason does not exist in space, it is not conceivable that it can exist in man. Man cannot be a unique creature. Neither his magnitude nor his attainment justifies such arrogance. Therefore, every condition, state, or quality which exists partially in man must exist totally in the universe itself. So the ontology, in its effort to establish the nature of being, can follow either the scientific point of view, which seeks to restate the question, or can head straight into the metaphysical problem, which seeks to answer the question. When science approaches the question, who am I? Science takes usually the ground that this question in this form is unanswerable. Therefore, it amends the question. Instead of, who am I, it tells us that the ultimate possible answerable question about man is, what am I? When we say, what am I, we then move into a discussion of the attributes or qualities of man. Of what is he composed? What makes up his nature? What is the root or substance of his own personal existence? Science has some answers for this what, but no answer for the who. Science takes another important question and handles it in a very similar way. Science says that there is no answer to the ultimate question, why? Why is anything? The average 5-year-old child, beginning to become aware of the mystery of existence, has a certain audacity that has not been tempered by experience. Therefore, small children ask the question, why? They want to know why their parents act as they do. If the parent does not know, the question is extremely difficult. So science helping distracted parents and contributing what it can to the smothering of young minds takes the attitude that we cannot answer the question, why? Therefore, as one professor said, when we say why, we mean how. Now, why he didn't say how seems to be a little dim. But at the same time, we are supposed to automatically exchange one word for the other. How opens a different kind of world. We can answer the question, how is man formed? If we are willing to limit this to the study of the prenatal epic. We know how he came into existence. If we want to go a little further and examine into the fertilization of the ovum. But when we ask forthrightly, why, this is much more difficult. How we got here, up to a point, is understandable. Why we are here in the first place is unknowable. Now, science does not like to deal with unknowables. They are always embarrassing wherever they occur. Therefore, in order to retain a certain complacency, it has narrowed the area. It has built a wall between physics and metaphysics and forbade anyone to look over the wall. If you look over the wall, you are a sickly mystic. If you dare to go beyond the circumference which has been established by formal technique, you are then held to have lost your scientific orientation and to be wandering about in a sea of conflicting absurdities. This, however, does not entirely discourage philosophy, although I think we can say that it has discouraged most 20th century philosophers. They say old Professor Jowett of Oxford was the last man who was not discouraged by this particular situation. With him, universal knowledge is said to have perished. But the fact remains that man has been endowed with the power to ask the unpleasant questions. He has been given, even in his childhood, the courage to ask the basic why. He has also been given the faculties which will not rest until he is able to penetrate the obvious and come to some deeper insight into the substance of his own nature. Reason will attack head-on problems that science has not the courage to assail. Science, therefore, assumes that reasonable procedures have no foundation in scientific procedure. Aristotle denies this when he affirms that the reason is a scientific instrument, the most complete and perfect of all instruments. For without it, every other instrument either fails or could never have been devised. Yet if we take all other instruments away, reason itself remains and can reconstruct anything that has ever existed and fashion anything that is yet necessary. So it is not well to sell reason short. It is better to try to understand that reason naturally deals with either physical or moral abstractions and must bring them into order and must create the codes and concepts which govern all specialized knowledge. Dealing from the ontological point of view, therefore, metaphysics deals first with the nature of being. Can being be defined? The answer is, can man be defined? If anything which exists can be defined, then being, which is existence, can be defined. What we cannot accomplish is a blanket definition. We cannot create a definition that exhausts the potential of being. But we can establish a certain basic concept. First of all, a thing to exist must be. If anything exists, the principle of being exists. There can be no escaping this rather obvious but neglected truism. Being is therefore an establishment in time, place, or space. Being is something which has of itself an endurance. Reason has never been able to accomplish a thoughtful apperception of a condition or time in which being did not exist. Nor can we rationally comprehend any time in which being ceases to exist. Being, by its very nature, can have no beginning, nor can it have an end. If it had a beginning, we are utterly defeated, for the reason that if there is a beginning to that which is primordial, eternal, and unchanging, if this had a beginning, it could never have existed, because there is nothing from which being itself could descend. If being, therefore, is not eternal, it could not be, for there is nothing from which it could be generated. If it was generated from itself, we are in the same dilemma, for then being could only be generated from being, and we are right where we started from, that being itself is eternal. We cannot assume or conceive that being can end. For that which ends must have had a beginning. These are the requisites. We used to refer in theological studies to what has been called the theological one-ended stick, but we do not hold it in great regard. This one-ended stick is something that starts as a beginning and then goes on forever and ever. This is the one-ended stick, and there is no such a thing. Consequently, when we say that being comes into existence, or we try to assume that the uncreate, the continuing unchangingness, if we assume that this comes into so-called existence, we must then affirm that existence is only one of the aspects of being, and that being apparently is created simply because it changes its appearances but not its substances. If something emanating from being, which we have not previously known or seen, comes into the area of our physical comprehension, we say this thing was created, or that it has come in some way out of the everywhere into the here and is with us. But this cannot be assumed to mean that this thing which we first comprehend at a certain state of its own existence began where the comprehension began, or had no existence prior to the time in which we could comprehend it. Thus, ontology is confronted with a very severe choice. Being is either forever or for never. Now, if we assume that being is for never, that there is no such thing as being, we take a very absurd position, because we wipe out ourselves along with everything else. And as one observer in the philosophical world once said, rather pathetically, that if we could actually eliminate ourselves, we could explain everything. But this does not seem to be very convenient either. Consequently, we finally come to the conclusion that man is as a creature, has the power to conceive within himself the existence of a nature, abiding forever in eternity, permeating, penetrating all things, having in itself an inevitable continuum, and that this thing which exists must properly be termed being, essence, or substance. We say that it is essence because it is the most subtle part of all things. We say that it is substance because it is the only endurance, as Plato points out. That which has the greatest endurance has the greatest substance and reality, although we cannot perceive it. So ontology, certainly in the classical period, came to the rather quiet and actually irrefutable position that universe, cosmos, the vast galaxies of stars, the vast expanse of the Milky Way and others extending to infinity beyond our comprehension, choir after choir of angelic forces, all of these exist within and of being. They are, therefore being is. Being is, therefore they are. Having established this, we establish the ultimate reservoir of condition. For being becomes not only the total reality, but it becomes the total substance and source of all that exists. There is no longer any problem of creation being fashioned out of nothing. The old Rosicrucian adage, nothing from nothing comes, appeals at this moment. Everything arises in something. Nothing arises in nothing. And because all things do arise, and we behold this vast expanse of existence, we therefore say that it arises from being, it originates in being, it is perpetuated by being, it is nourished and sustained from the substance of being, and when it appears to disappear, vanish away, or cease to exist, it has merely returned again to the essence of being itself. Thus we no longer have an empty space dotted with creation. We have an infinite life surrounding and penetrating all so-called space and sustaining this infinite diversity of manifestation within itself. Once we solve this problem to the best of our ability, and reason seems to convey to us that we have approached as nearly as we can to the ultimate hypothesis, we now hypothecate a universe of infinite supply, a universe which contains within itself all that is necessary for itself, and that this continually renewing existence renews from the totality of its own available elements, principles, and essences. The second point that comes to the metaphysical consideration is not so much what we shall call this ultimate, this absolute, this unconditioned. But we must now move this unconditioned from its own eternal subsistence to what we might call a state of activity. In other words, how does the infinite, for any reason whatsoever, curtail its own infiniteness? Because it becomes obvious that universals give rise in themselves to particulars. By what peculiar power does this universal variously restrict itself, condition itself, partition itself, and cause to arise from its own totality the phenomenon of parts? The ancients held this to be perhaps one of the deepest of all mysteries, and there have been several efforts to explain it. Perhaps Aristotle's explanation was as good as any other. He probably derived it, at least in part, from the older fragments of the Pythagorean lore. Now, Aristotle takes the ground that being, because it is totality, contains inevitably within itself what might be termed an archetypal nature. Plato's doctrine of archetypes appears here. Being, though infinite, is still in a mysterious way a being. Being, because it is total, is the only creature, creation, power, or substance that has total knowledge. Not knowledge of a mental nature, not knowledge as we know it, not thought or mind as we understand these things, but a total existence in which none of these attributes is deficient. Being is therefore the ultimate of mind. It is the ultimate of substance. It is the ultimate of essence. It is the ultimate of process. And it is conceivable, at least Aristotle so held the conception, perhaps following Plato's definition of the divine animal. Plato and Aristotle are in rather close agreement, therefore, that this being, this essence, is not apart from law, but possesses or holds within itself not only substances but processes. The ultimate processes of all things are therefore an infinite pattern residing forever in the infinite itself. This infinite pattern arises not from mind, but mind from the pattern. This is why the Egyptians and some of the Oriental peoples point out clearly that it is the thought that produces the thinker, and not the thinker who produces the thought. What we call the thinker is a process in the unfoldment of the process of the thought itself. So the concept, simply stated, is this, that all of the conditions that arise in being are inevitable because being itself is inevitable and contains all inevitability. Our comparatively patient and not particularly well-recognized Tibetan brothers not too numerous, far from our ken of knowledge and science and all these things, have stated it very simply, but perhaps as wisely as any other group that ever existed. Namely, that there is a periodicity in the archetype of existence. Through existence means vast motions that are essentially part of its own nature. As the body of man carries within it the circulation of the blood, as the vast pageantries of the universe result in the mutations of seasons, as the tides are variously controlled, as all things have an ebbing and flowing of themselves, whether it be the ebbing and flowing of waking and sleeping, or of life or death, or of growth or decay, or of coming forth and declining or retiring from manifestation. These principles, reason tells us, have their final abidance in being itself. Therefore, being is capable of causing to arise in itself, or perhaps in the Hindu thought more accurately, is unable to prevent the rise within itself of the great cycles of periodicity. Consequently, being is of its nature infinitely and totally fruitful, and is constantly bearing fruit, this fruit being the harvest of the worlds, as the old wisdom of the Hebrew elders has pointed out to us. So to explain creation, we simply realize that creation is an eternal process, that creation is part of the foreverness of being, that there was never a time when creation was not. But all creations as such, like all men as such, have their beginnings and their ends. But just as all men must perhaps limit their years to 40 or 50, yet humanity never ends. This is because of the infinite creativity of life, constantly replacing that which vanishes away, and therefore constantly continuing, although the particular instruments of continuance may change, so to eternity of being as such, we add the eternity of process as such. We add to this concept, then, that creativity is forever, that never the time it was not, and there is never a time when it shall cease. Yet everything moving within this vast process, except being itself, has a continuance only in time, having a beginning and an end. And this beginning is in being, and the end is in being. But being itself continues to manifest from itself infinite life forever. This brings then to the minds of the ancients who devised these problems the next important consideration, and that is the nature of God. Shall we assume that God is identical with being? We have here two distinct points of view. Here we have the emergence of other phases or factors in the potential totality of the essence of being. Being is of a manifold nature, yet of all of the things which it contains within itself, the forces, powers, principles, and energies resident in it, there is one most mysterious, primordial, as difficult to define as being itself, and as some have held, co-eternal with being. Or at least, if not co-eternal, the first and inevitable production of being. And to this, the ancients applied the term consciousness. Though consciousness really means awareness, we are not assured that in its own essence and substance, being is aware. But we do know that it produces from itself infinite awareness, and that this infinite awareness always finally turns toward the conscious experience of the nature of the infinite itself. This awareness, therefore, in man, is the awareness of himself. He may be aware of this, but he cannot examine the object of his awareness. In the universe, consciousness is the eternal awareness of the nature and existence of being. But this awareness may or may not be capable of understanding itself. But consciousness becomes, so to say, the symbol of the objectivity of being. The first manifestation of being is infinite consciousness. An infinite consciousness carries within it its own substance or nature, with which it is also co-identical. For an infinite consciousness is therefore one with infinite life. Life consciousness being terms for the aspects of one thing. Consciousness in itself is life. Consciousness in its manifestation is awareness, or the power of life to bestow upon creatures the sense of self-existence. So the ancients came to the conclusion that if we would properly and definitely define a deity, we must assume that God is primordial consciousness. It is the primordial self-knower arising from the eternally unknown. The self-knower, however, cannot, as far as we can comprehend at least, be actually capable of knowing its own source. God is therefore like the Scandinavian Allfather, the great culture hero Odin, and where we are told in the ancient sagas that Odin, the god of the world, knew everything except his own nature and his own fate. This he could not know. These things were beyond him. But deity represents the island of consciousness arising in the great ocean of being. This island of consciousness comes forth according to the infinite law that being is forever flowing into manifestation through a focal area set up, which is called consciousness. And the primary end of consciousness is that it shall expound, define, restrict, limit, and reveal that which is the law of being itself. Therefore, consciousness becomes the basis of the power to interpret the processes arising from being. This is the way the ancients sought to explain this. And this covers that phase of our subject which is essentially referred to as ontology. Anyone can argue these points to the end of time. It is perfectly possible for the most ignorant person to deny that which you can neither define nor comprehend. It is perfectly possible to take this mysterious void, which is the extreme apex of metaphysics, and declare it to contain whatever we will that it should contain, or that it shall not contain, anything that we will that it shall not contain. But the fact remains that whether we recognize or accept, or do not recognize or deny, we in no way alter the nature of being itself. Whatever it is, that it is. And from that thatness comes everything that exists. So we then pass to the next branch of our subject, which is the nature of knowledge and of truth. And here, I think we have already somewhat anticipated our situation. Knowledge and truth represent two expressions of a thing. We assume that knowledge is true. That which is not true is not knowledge, said our old friend Dr. Jelly. And we also assume that the end of knowledge is that we shall know that which is true. We then come to a very interesting problem in metaphysics, which is summarized in the famous question asked by Pilate at the time when Christ was brought before him. He looked at the Nazarene and he asked the question, "What is truth?" And the Nazarene was silent. Truth, therefore, is the ultimate abstraction of all knowledge to the point that knowledge itself is united with being. Therefore, truth is ultimately the perfect and complete knowledge of being. Not only its substance, but its processes. Under such absolute terms,